Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who wants to be stroked by Goldie the dog as he dies. It's Richard Herring!
Thank you! Hello! How you doing? Hello! It's like a royal box at the start here with just two guys. There's only two guys right at the front. They booked the entire front row for themselves. I'll have to show the people at the video watchers at home. There's the two men. They'd planned a nice little evening out together. They thought it'd be discreet. Then there's all these empty seats around. Those will fill up as the evening goes on. Possibly not. Anyway, welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or as some of the cool people just recently have started calling it, Rahelastapur. You're very good. This is the last recording day. Oh, no, it's given away that we don't. When I say you're much better than last week's audience next week, that's going to wreck it. This is the end of the series coming up. So we've got two podcasts for the audience here today who are much better than last week's audience. They are. Some of them are the same. For people who've been watching on video or are literally here and can see me, during the course of this run, I have dropped from 90.4 kilograms. Today I'm 87.7 kilograms. So hopefully you can sort of see that. As you watch, if you watch Meaning of Life, my other show, Rich Herring's Meaning of Life, I was about 96 kilos at the start of that, and that's going on for another 2 months. So hopefully, you know, it'll be, if you watch it backwards, it'll be like, that's just foolish. It's just foolish. I'm very, very tired, which I think will be all right in this first podcast. But when Nick Helm comes on, I'll probably just fall asleep. Because I've been touring. I was in Hull on Saturday. I was in Cardiff yesterday. You like Hull? You were in Hull on Saturday. You come down specially from Hull. How was the gig in Hull? Oh, you want to see Peter Hook? Were you in Hull on Saturday? You were in Hull and you went to see Peter Hook. I was in Hull. Fucker. What's your name? Murray. Murray as in mince. Not mince. Oh, he's going to be trouble. This guy should never have. Never. I'll give you one more try. What do you do for a living? You have a shop. That's nice. What do you sell in the shop? Men's stuff. Do you know anything about this? Is this where you met each other in this shop? Men's stuff, that's good. Oh dear, they're going to be trouble. It's too good. There's some lovely ladies over here. I'll talk to you two instead. Hello, what are your names? Catherine and Alice. It's very nice. Is this the first time you've been to see this live? No, you've been on a few times. Have you still come back? Never picked on you though before, have I? No. What do you do, Kat? And when I say picked on you, had a lovely conversation with. What do you do for a living, Catherine? You're a receptionist. Whereabouts do you recep? In Melbourne, Australia. You've come a long way for this. This is wow. And what's the business? The accountants, not like him. Fucking dildo. He's got he's got a dildo shop. That's what he's got. He's got a bank. Just massive dildos. That's what he's got. And only men are allowed to use them. That's the worst thing about it. Girls come and go, oh, but like, and no, you can't have that. That's a proper job. And are you from Australia also? No. How did you two get together? It's a crazy. You just met, literally just sitting next to each other. Oh, you look like such good friends. Let us know how the relationship gets on. I have got a video camera and I would love it. If you've really enjoyed the series. If you've really enjoyed it, because I don't really get paid anything for this, so if you've really enjoyed the series, that would be the best way to. If you became friends! And then let's stop. So, welcome everyone. Oh dear. Last week I got a bit overexcited. It was Harry Shearer, and then I talked to Susan Cabin. I was a bit tired and overexcited by the end of the second one, so I apologise for all the things I said last week. And you know what? I'm going to apologise in advance for all the things I'm going to say during this. Let us crack on, I think. I've warmed you up there, good and proper. No one could argue with that. Before I do, I've got two. I'm quite obsessed with the Dirty Britcom Confessions website, if you've been listening to this series. There are two new ones that have come up about me, which, again, I think are from people trying to get read out in the podcast. But let's read them out in the podcast to make them happy. Well, the new ones are, please can Richard Herring goose me already? Yes, but you have to tell me who you are, because if I just go around goosing people, I will get into all kinds of trouble, as many celebrities have found out. But I'm happy to do that as a service. If anyone just ask, will you? Does it work being goosed if you have to ask for it, or is it something that has to happen unasked for? I don't know. It's not something I would do. Someone else says, I'm constantly distracted by thoughts of Richard Herring in that flower bathtub, which there's not many fans of, as it occurs to me, which, thank goodness. So those are my two new sexual fantasies. You got any sexual fantasies about me, Murray? No? Not yet. Still time. I'm a bit worried about you two sitting there. It's like there were people sitting here. And they've either disappeared or they've decided to leave. So one way or the other, you two are going to be trouble. Look, let's crack on. We've got a fantastic first guest. He is a man who is probably best, you'll know him best, because he was the manager of the 1980s indie band Man from Del Monte. That is why you've all come out. Will you please welcome John Ronson, ladies and gentlemen? Come in, welcome. Sit down. Pull up a mic. There is more
You can take it out of there, otherwise it's going to get weird.
Hello.
There's more beer for you there, should you require it.
I do feel that you would have all have heard of the man from Del Monte had they landed less inept management.
Yeah, it might be the manager's fault. You weren't the manager for the whole time.
No.
You're the temporary manager.
I was the manager for 3 years.
Oh, that's quite a long time.
Yeah.
You should have made them a hit.
I managed them into the ground.
What happened? What happened with the man from Del Monte? You must talk about this all the time. So we'll get this out of the way first.
I was fired for having an affair with the singer's girlfriend.
Oh, that was a mistake.
yeah. And so it was a rightful firing.
You're allowed to do that if it was her choice as well.
It coincided also, I was in the Frank Side Bottom O' Blimey big band,
yes.
And it coincided with me being fired from that too, for tax reasons. Chris owed £30,000 back tax,
yeah.
And he stood up in court and the judge said, "This is a very serious matter. Have you considered a payment plan?" And he said, "Would £1 a week suffice, Millard?" And the judge said, "No, it would not." So,
and was he wearing his head?
He wasn't wearing the head.
That is Frank Sideburn, who I'm sure we'll get on to later. I thought of a good joke, which would have been really funny if I'd said it just when you were talking about it. But the man from Del Monte's girlfriend, she says yes as well. It's still quite funny, even now. But imagine if I'd said it, I thought about it 1 second too late. That's just because I'm a little bit too... I'm just off my game, just slightly. Usually that would be fine.
I'd love to know, but does anybody in there... It's like 300 people here, so this is presumably... does anyone remember the man from Del Monte? Yes!
Wow, two people.
Do you remember any of their songs?
Do you remember any of their songs?
Yes. Yeah. Water in My Eyes, Drive, Drive, Drive.
See, you're a good manager. You remember two of their songs. It could be better than that. Yeah. So, what were you doing? How did you get into band management? What were you doing around in the mid 80s before you became a journalist?
Basically, I was the social secretary. I was the Ent secretary at the Polytechnic of Central London. In fact, the guy who was doing the Ents at UCL was Ricky Gervais. Ah. Yeah, and so. We were like, we'd book the bands, and I'd have to say Ents, they'd phone up, and I'd say Ents, because that's what my predecessor said, and I was like, I'd been shadowing him. And one time, the phone rang, and I said, Ents, and the voice said, "What?" And I said, "Ents," and he said, "Oh, Jesus, I thought you said Ants." Listen, Frank's supposed to be playing in London tonight, but our keyboard players had a nervous breakdown, and so we're going to have to cancel unless you know any keyboard players. So I said, I play keyboards. And he said, "Well, you're in." I said, "But I don't know any of your songs." And he said, "Wait a minute." And I heard, mm-hmm. Then he came back and he said, "Can you play C, F, and G?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, you're in. Turn up at the Cricketers at 5 p.m. And Frank's real name's Chris." And they kind of put the phone down.
Yeah.
And so I went to the Cricketers in the Oval. Yes. And I found out by then that Frank was Frank Sidebottom, but he wore a big fake head.
Yes.
And I was wondering, I saw these men playing with leads on the floor. And I thought, which one of them is Frank? And they all turned and looked at me, and I thought, would there be some kind of facial clue? And then I saw this other figure in the shadows turn, and it was Frank, and he was wearing the big fake head,
yeah,
and these two eyes staring at me. And I thought, God, is it like Dead of Night, when the ventriloquist dummy takes over the ventriloquist?
Yeah.
And I said, "Hi, Chris, I'm John." And I said, silence. And then I said, "Hello, Frank." And he went, "Hello." And I got to join the band. I played that night.
Yeah.
They taught me the songs. Mike, the manager, said, "Can you teach John the songs?" And Frank kind of turned away from me and took his head off like he was sort of shyly undressing. And underneath he had a little nose peg on, like an orthopedic brace, and he kind of demurely took off and then gave me like a sort of apologetic smile as if to say, "I'm sorry that you had to, witness such weirdness, but it's out of my control." And I taught me the songs, and they were all C, F, and G, and the odd A, but not the full range, yeah. Not the full 16 notes, or however many there are.
None of the black notes.
Yeah, no, God no. Actually, that's not true. In Anarchy and Timpoli, we played the black notes.
Okay.
Oh, I am an antichrist, and that was black notes.
Right.
And
as you know, professional keyboardists call them.
Yeah. And then. And then they offered me the job full time.
Right.
So I immediately quit college and moved to Manchester. And that's how I ended up in the music business. And
it's insane that so this is one phone call that you happened to pick up the phone to, and if that hadn't happened, none of this stuff, and then subsequently...
The film that I've written, none of it would have happened. But it was just an amazing adventure. Nothing makes a young man feel more alive and on an adventure than speeding down the M6 at 2 a.m. next to a man wearing a big fake head.
So did he wear? Because in the film, I've seen the trailer for the film, mm-hmm. Which is called Frank, mm-hmm. and I don't know how. I'm feeling it's probably not a faithful rendition of Timpoli.
It's very unfaithful. Yeah. Yeah.
But how much did he actually wear the head then?
In real life, he kept it on beyond the call of duty.
Right.
But he didn't never take it off.
Yeah.
Our Frank, in the film that I've co-written, which is about to come out, never takes it off.
No.
Never. So so he has to say, so as not to be too intimidating, he has to say his facial expressions out loud.
Yes.
like lips, my favourite one of these. I co-wrote it with Peter Strawn, and he always got annoyed when I made the dialogue too mannered. But a couple of my mannered lines got through, and one of them was one of Frank's facial expressions. He announces his lips purse together as if to say enough frivolity.
So it's quite an interesting idea to take this experience and turn it into film. But obviously, the real Frank Sidebottom, Chris has died recently. And is there an element where you feel like you're taking someone else's life? I presume you think it's a tribute rather than anything else, but you are also taking his artistic creation and doing something with it yourself, which is quite an interesting...
Yeah, well, I mean, it was all agreed with him,
right?
You know, probably 2 or 3 years before he died.
Sure.
And he didn't want it to be a biopic, and I didn't want it to be a biopic.
No.
I think the worst thing in the world is a music business biopic. In fact, when I started writing it, I started looking at music business biopics to see what to avoid.
Yeah.
And the best two is the Karen Carpenter story. Right. There's always that moment when, you know, the thing that everybody knows about is kind of shoehorned laboriously into the plot. So in the Karen Carpenter story, they go, Karen, we've got an amazing review in Billboard. And she reads it, and it's Close to You is a wonderful first single by Richard Carpenter and his chubby sister Karen. And she goes, chubby? And then the other one was Summer Dreams, the story of the Beach Boys.
Oh, yeah, I think I've seen this.
Have you seen that one?
I think so. Well, like, we were obsessed with the biopic of the Beach Boys. I think it was that one.
Okay, well, it's the moment when Dennis Wilson's at a party.
Yeah.
And this man with, like, a beard comes up to him. It's Charles Manson. And he says, hey, you picked up one of my girls hitchhiking in Malibu the other day. I believe a race war's coming. It's going to be the end of the world as we know it.
People should have listened to him.
So I didn't want to write a biopic, and Chris didn't want Chris to be in the film. The only stipulation he ever gave us was he didn't want it to be a film about Chris. And I didn't want to write. I couldn't imagine myself writing like a Frank Sidebottom film, like Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
Yeah.
So the obvious thing to do was to completely fictionalise it and make it a sort of fairy story about a sort of version of me meeting a version of him.
Yeah.
And fictionalise it. So in the end, we kind of added all these other outsider artists and sort of made our Frank a sort of mashup of Frank Sidebottom and Daniel Johnston, the bipolar singer-songwriter. And so it's a sort of weird mix of all of those people.
Sure. And Mike Fassbender plays Frank.
Michael Fassbender.
But it could be anyone, really, couldn't it? You say it's him, but
you know what? I, I never went to the set, and so I got the rushes every day. I was fortunately in on the email list of the rushes, so I can vouch because I watched them all kind of assiduously. That at the end of each take, he takes the head off, and it is Fassbender.
I'm disappointed that he didn't method it and keep the head on all the time he was filming as well. That is very disappointing to me. That's what I would have done if you'd given me the part. I would have done it. So you've actually, this is you again in another film, because you've been fictionalised slightly, somewhat, in the A, you were played by Ewan McGregor. The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Yes.
So this is the. Is it, are there more than that? Or have you only had two films where you make an appearance? Again, it's quite a good looking actor. Really, I've only,
yeah.
I'm not saying you're not good looking, John.
Yeah, no, that was only the two. yeah, that was hard. Yeah. I don't know if people. Do people. No, should I explain?
Do they know who you are? I don't know. I don't know if they do.
Well, let's explain. Maybe the Men Who Stare at Goats.
We can talk about the Men Who Stare at Goats.
The Men Who Stare at Goats was. I just chanced on this story. I was in Hawaii and I met a man called Glenn Wheaton, who was a soldier, Special Forces soldier, and he was part of a secret military unit called Project Jedi.
When you say you chanced across the boat...
Well, we didn't just meet him in a bar. I mean, we knew, you know, that he existed. And we said,
didn't he just ring you up? You went, "Ent!" We went... It's like a code word. Oh, we have to tell him everything.
I think we found him because we were doing something on remote viewing. You know, remote viewing is that the US Army used to have a team of secret psychic spies in a condemned... which sounds great, right? Black op secret psychic spies. Sounds like the best job in the world. It's actually the worst fucking job in the world. Because A, because they're black op, they had no coffee budget, so they had to like bring their own coffee into work. And after like 20... And no, they couldn't get repairs done on their condemned clapboard building. And they basically had to stay in this fucking building, bringing their own coffee into work, trying to be psychic for 20 years. It's like the worst fucking job ever.
But they wouldn't know where the best coffee was being made, though, so they could just go, here it is, let's drive there.
Well, it would have worked. but it was through them I heard about Glenn Wheaton.
Right.
And he was part of the secret unit called Project Jedi. So I met him, and he said that Project Jedi was a series of levels. Yeah. And I said, what was level one? He said, level one was observation. You walk into a room... How many chairs are in the room? The super soldier would just know.
So it's the main threat against soldiers, a chair. Yeah. So they do have to know. They...
So I said, what was level two? And he said, level two was intuition. You know, a fork in the road. Do you go left? Do you go right? You go right. It's true that these guys...
That's not intuition, that's you just go right. That is just deciding... Yeah. You decide based on intuition is the answer to that.
So I said, what was level three? And he said, level three was invisibility. I said, that's quite a leap. I said, what, actual invisibility? And he said, at first... But after a while, we adapted it to trying to find a way of not being seen. So I said, oh, like camouflage. And he went, no. And then level four was they had a master sergeant that could stop the heart of a goat.
Yeah.
Just by wanting it to stop.
And he could do it. I can't remember. Could he do it?
Did it one time. Did it one. But his heart.
Well, you know, on the law of averages, that's going to...
Well, at one point...
I could stare at goats for about 6 years, and then one day, one of them fall over dead. Yeah.
Well, actually, at one point, they had 30 goats in a room, and they all stared at goat number 16, had numbers on the goats, and number 17 fell over, which I suppose is... I suppose is collateral damage.
Yeah. It's difficult with the goats to remember which number they are, that's the thing. So 17 probably thought he was 16.
I said to him, because apparently his heart got, the starer's heart got damaged in the process. So I said, what was the goat psychically fighting back? And he said, no, the goat didn't stand a chance. He said it's what's known in paranormal circles as sympathetic injury.
So it's kind of, you know, you're very good at, I mean, I guess if there's a theme running through all of your work, it is kind of madness. I would say that everyone, you kind of concentrate on that, and everyone you, well, not everyone, but a lot of people you interview have are insane, probably.
Yeah.
Or magic. Well, or actually, UFOs.
Well, that was always sort of, I suppose, in my first few books, that was like the kind of elephant in the room, I suppose. And then in my last but one book, it became what the book was about, which is a book called The Psychopath Test.
Yeah.
Which is about, you know, the actual, I suppose it's about the sort of tyranny of labelling and diagnoses, and also the possibility that psychopaths rule the world. And so it became a book about that, you know, that book's a book about madness.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that leads on from all the sort of Bilderberg group and David Icke and stuff, that it's not necessarily lizards slash Jews.
This is the story about, you know, the David Icke believed that, you know, the global elite were blood-drinking, child-sacrificing, paedophile lizards. And Jewish rights group, like the Anti-Defamation League, all convinced that when he said giant blood-drinking paedophile lizards, he was using code. What he actually meant was Jews, to which David Icke said, no, actually, I'm really honestly, I mean lizards. And they said, that's code too. I love that because, you know, the crazier the extremists get, the crazier do our responses towards them. It was like a kind of cold war of paranoia.
Yeah, but a lot of this stuff does. I mean, basically, conspiracy theories and all this thing. It comes from the idea that the world is ordered enough for people to, you know, to be able to control stuff. Which is not. So it's almost like a comforting idea that the world runs by clockwork and that evil things can only happen because someone's orchestrating it and there must be someone in control of everything. So it's replacing...
Yeah, and it sort of fits into the sort of Miss Marple-ish, you know, ness that we'd like to have about ourselves. You know, we like to sort of solve mysteries and... I mean, the thing that really... Well, one of the things that really bugs me about conspiracy theories, frankly, is that they don't like put in any of the legwork. They don't like get on planes. They just get it all from Alex Jones videos on YouTube and then get a little furious if somebody like me comes along and has actually done a bit of research and it refutes what they say and then, you know, I accidentally type my name into Google and see, you know, these kind of threads basically saying I'm part of the New World Order.
Yeah.
Because they're so, you know, because their belief system has just become so kind of sacrosanct.
Yeah, but
to
you
them.
Would say that, wouldn't you? If you were one of the lizards, he is one of the lizards. So, do you think any of the conspiracy theories are true, though? Do you think there's a? Do you think because there must be, like, all of these things? One of them must be like, just by the law of averages, one must have come through and actually be.
Well, there's certain... I mean, I remember when I first started writing my book Them, people were talking about this mysterious, shadowy group called the Bilderberg Group.
Yeah.
And nobody had ever heard of them. It was like a... and people thought they didn't exist. And I thought they didn't exist. But I kept hearing it, actually. I remember an Islamic militant called Omar Bakri Muhammad was telling me about the Bilderberg Group and how they secretly rule the world. And then I went to Arkansas and I met a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan, whose their leader, Tom Robb, had... he was trying to kind of give them an image makeover, so he banned the robes and the hoods and the N-word and the cross burnings. He kind of banned all the things that, you know,
The fun bits.
The fun bits, yeah. It was funny, actually, because he had a... he allowed one cross burning a year. And on like the special clan day, whatever that day was, July the 4th or something. And they were all so rusty that they couldn't remember. They were all standing around this giant cross saying, do we soak it in kerosene and then raise it? Or do we raise it and then soak it? And then Tom came over and said, Tom, do we soak it and then raise it? And he said, you soak it and then raise it. How are you going to soak it after you've raised it? So then he kind of looked at me as if to say, I am sorry that my Klansmen are such idiots. He liked me more than his Klansmen, I could tell. He was very nebbishy, this guy. It was weird to find yourself toning down your Jewish character traits so as not to alienate a Ku Klux Klan leader who's basically exactly like Woody Allen. He put on these like personality skills workshops in a marquee in his compound. Well, the Klansmen had to fill in those multiple choice questionnaires, like which strengths or weaknesses most apply to you. And I always remember one of them was mixes easily, which to non-Klansmen would be a strength, but a weakness for Klansmen, right? Because of the blood separation thing. Anyway, they also told me about the existence of the Bilderberg Group. Right. So I began to think, well, maybe it is true. So I tracked them down with the help of a Bilderberg expert called Big Jim Tucker.
Right.
He said they do exist, and they're meeting at the Caesar Park Hotel and Golfing Resort, Sintra, Portugal, at the end of May, and that's where they're going to rule the world from. And I'm going to climb up the drain pipes, get in, and confront them red-handed, going about their covert wickedness. So I said, "Can I come?" And sure enough, we were chased by the Bilderberg Group.
Yeah, they would have guards. That was the first thing. They would have, like, you know, stormtroopers, wouldn't they?
They had guards. They followed. A car chase ensued when we left the hotel. Well, I say a car chase. I was going 29 miles an hour, so he was too. But if I'd sped up, he would have fucking sped up. And I phoned the British Embassy, and I panicked so fucking badly. I can't tell you. I phoned up my wife, and I said, "I'm being chased by the Bilderberg Group's henchmen." But I said, and it's just, I'm way out of, you know, it's not working out, and I'm so sorry, and I don't think I'm ever going to see you again. And she said, "Oh, you're loving it."
And she was right. How did you escape?
Well, I found the British Embassy, and I said, "I'm being chased by the Bilderberg Group," and she went, and then she went, "Go on." And I said, I just heard you take a sharp breath. And she said, "Well, what are you doing here?" She said, and I had my hand to God, she said, "Bilderberg is much bigger than we are. We're just a little embassy." She said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm essentially a humorous journalist out of my depth." I said, What I didn't put in the book was it was too painful. I said, I'm a bit like Louis Theroux, and she said, "Oh." And I said, "But he actually is quite often cited me as an inspiration."
Right.
And she said, "Oh." And she's probably thinking, this guy's about to be killed by the Bilderberg, and this is how he's choosing to spend his last moments on Earth.
It's important to get it sorted out.
Yeah. And then we got back to the hotel, and the British Embassy called me back, and they said that they'd spoken to the Bilderberg office at the Caesar Park, and they said that nobody was following us, and they couldn't call off somebody who didn't exist. So I said, "He's behind the tree." I was sitting by the pool. He was standing behind the tree looking at me. And she said, oh, my God, I just remember this. She said, "The good news..." She said, "As if you know you're being followed, they won't be the dangerous ones. The dangerous ones are the ones who you don't know are following you." And I thought two things at once about this. I thought, A, how does the press officer for the Portuguese embassy know this? And secondly, what if these people were the dangerous ones and I just happened to be naturally good at spotting them?
But also, it must be embarrassing to be one of the second-tier Bilderberg henchmen with the reputation that you aren't very good at what you're doing. It's like, they must know, go, "Well, we never get to go out with the other guys, the invisible guys. We're always following the lesser people. We must be the ones who are shit at this."
Well, he was shit. At one point, he stopped his car. I stopped my car. If he'd stopped his car, I would have got away. Yeah. I stopped my car, and so he stopped his car. And I walked over to him, and I had a press card, and I kind of tried to wave it, and he just was assiduously looking ahead, like he didn't want to, you know, he was making a point of not wanting to know who I was.
Yeah.
This was like one of the worst days of my life, which subsequently became one of the best days of my life because actually I learnt a really good lesson about journalism on that day, which was basically you can only really tell a story if you can feel what your interviewees are feeling. And yes. I was feeling insanely paranoid and suddenly believing in the evil power of the Bilderberg Group. And as a result, the story was a million times better for
us. And do you think they are just some businessmen who like to get together and play golf with each other, or are they doing... I mean, they're all the rich people in the world obviously have a vested interest in staying being the richest people in the world, and presumably will occasionally bump people off who are getting in their way.
I mean, I think it's probably a bit of both. I mean, yeah. I think they do... They don't meet for no reason. I mean, you know, they meet and they go to a lot of effort to meet. What they said... Eventually, I got to talk to a few of them. The Secretary General of the Bilderberg Group around that time was a guy called Martin Taylor, who was the head of Barclays.
Right.
And I think he was the head of WH Smith.
He can't be called Martin Taylor and be an evil...
Blofeld. although, as I say, the psychopath test, if you really want to like get away with wielding true malevolent evil, be boring, because journalists, you know, we don't like writing about boring people, so actually maybe he was. Yeah. And what they would say was that they were globalists, like early globalists. So, you know, they'd just gone through the Second World War. They didn't want a world, you know, with more Hitlers. They thought the worst thing in the world was ideological politicians. And what they wanted to do was kind of take ideology out of politics. And who were the least ideological people? Businessmen. So they wanted to kind of take power from politics and put it into the hands of business. I mean, this is what they said to me was basically the reason for the existence of the Bilderberg Group. So the idea was to then put together business and politics and you know, hopefully the powerful business people would offer the rising politicians wise words.
Yeah. Although what happens, you're giving power to people who just want to try and accrue as much stuff for themselves as possible, the worst people to put in charge. Yeah, we'll have everything, and you can have hardly anything.
It's funny that I did that story, it's quite an old story, that one. I did that story like in the, I don't know, about 1997. And back then, it did feel quite like, you're right, business is more rational and less, you know, hysterical than politics. Yeah. But then, you know, history proved business to be just as shit at leading the world as politics.
I seem to remember when, from them, going back to that, though, that you wrote that, came out before 9/11.
Yeah.
But there was a sort of warning within them about Islamic extremism, I remember, because I remember when it happened, I went, it's just like John Ronson said, although I think it was... 9/11 was probably more than you were imagining was going to happen.
But... It was a bit more. I was spending time. I mean, Omar Bakri back then was calling himself Osama bin Laden's man in Great Britain, which I noticed he stopped calling himself after 9/11. But yeah, it was weird. I mean, I was at the Finsbury Park Mosque. I was with these people who would eventually, years later, go on to commit acts of terrorism.
Yeah.
I remember I was outed as a Jew at Omar's jihad training camp in Crawley. He said, look at me with the infidel John, who is a Jew. And everyone went, I said, surely it's better to be a Jew than an atheist. And I heard someone go, no, it isn't.
Why can't everyone just get on? That's what.
I should have swallowed before I gesticulated. Swallow and then gesticulate. What happened afterwards was that they all surrounded me, like all these young jihad trainees, they all surrounded me and were basically treating me like a rare fish you would find at the bottom of a coral reef. And they were like, one of them said to me, I've never met a Jew before. Kind of, what's it like? And I said, it's all right. And I kind of left the jihad training camp feeling quite strongly that it was like hands across the ocean.
That's,
yeah.
It's like the Christmas Day armistice. That's why if you get together, you go, oh, we're just the same.
Yeah.
Then, so you're not allowed to be. You have to keep everyone separate so they can carry on the hatred. That's the important thing.
Yes.
The needless hatred. Aren't we more or less exactly the same? No, we're very, very different.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
We'll move on to at the end of the Managed Sarah of Goats, though, to get back to that. Doesn't he? Well, this is a spoiler from my. Don't you walk through a wall at the end of? That didn't happen in the book.
It didn't happen in the screenplay either.
Oh, really?
The way the Managed Sarah of Goats starts the book and the film is a general, and this is a true story. A general is sitting behind his desk. General Stubblebine the Third, Albert Stubblebine the Third. Head of army intelligence with like 16,000 soldiers under his command. I mean, the head of US military intelligence gets up from behind his desk and starts like walking really fast and then breaks into a run and smashes into the wall because he thinks that, you know, with the right mental preparation, you can pass through your wall.
Yeah.
Because the atom. I remember him telling me it's because the atom is made up mostly of space.
That is true.
Yeah, although I do think that the key word to this is mostly, right? And it's true. In the movie, Peter Strawn, who I co-wrote Frank with, wrote the screenplay for the Managed Sarah of Goats. Yeah. And actually, the screenplay ended with my character, Ewan McGregor.
Ewan McGregor.
Yeah. Running, which is something I didn't do in real life, running towards a wall, and just as he's about to hit the wall, it cuts to black,
right.
And Boston's More Than a Feeling comes on. But then when we saw the film at the premiere, he passes through the wall. So Grant Heslov, the director, decided to make John walk through, run, actually managed to make it through the wall.
I tell you what he should have done. Uh-huh. He should have... It's not what you're going to think. I'll tell you that later. But... He should have had Ewan McGregor come out of the cinema screen in every showing of it. Should have run at the wall. And then Ewan McGregor bursts out and goes, oh, that'd be fucking brilliant. He should at least have done that at the premiere.
Yeah.
But it would have been pretty cool if he'd done it every single showing. And the actual Ewan McGregor had to just drive around and time it very carefully.
Yeah,
next time, try that.
Yeah.
And he should have put a Shrek in it as well. Are you happy now? You happy? First, I think that's the first time. First time of the series. They had a gay bomb as well. Was this the same? These are the same guys.
Yeah, these are the same minister. These are stories I'd forgotten all about.
Yeah.
You're right. They were trying to. As well as trying to walk through walls and kill goats just by staring at them, they also had developed a range of non-lethal weapons, proposed or developed.
Yeah.
And yeah, one of them was the. There was a race-specific stink bomb.
Right.
There was a neck gun.
Yeah.
They did manage the neck gun. Actually, years later, I met a real-life superhero called Phoenix Jones in Seattle. I went on patrol with Phoenix Jones, the real-life superhero, and he used to have a neck gun. And one time it went off by accident and encased him as he was chasing a criminal. And the police had to cut him free. And so... So he left instead of leaving the net gun at home. He also had grappling hooks, but he Phoenix, but he left them at home because A, they were very heavy, and B, he realised that actually you scale a building with grappling hooks, and then what do? You just have to come back down again. It's like a completely pointless...
Come down in the lift.
Yeah, an utterly pointless superhero fighting device. However, I know this is a tangent, and yes. Forgive me for this tangent.
No, it's
tangent.
All right, I'm very happy with
okay.
tangents.
But when I was patrolling with Phoenix Jones, the real-life superhero, so basically, he goes out into the night and thwarts crime, but he gets very frustrated when he doesn't manage to thwart any crime. And I was patrolling with him, and there was, like, no crime to thwart anywhere. At one point, we heard somebody screaming, a woman screaming, and Phoenix went, Yahtzee! Started running towards it. And then some people screeched to a halt in a car and said, it's the guy from YouTube. And he kind of stopped. And I said, can we have your photograph? And he said, OK. And then by the time, the screaming woman had just vanished. Anyway, after a couple of days of this, he was, like, very frustrated. And he kind of pulled out, basically, you know, the ace up his sleeve. And he said, we'll go to Belltown. So I thought, OK. And so we went to Belltown. And it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, and we turned the corner, and it was like The Wire. It was like, it was fucking terrifying. There was like 30 crack dealers. A couple of days earlier, we'd broken up a gang of crack addicts at a bus stop by just walking past them, and they all kind of dispersed, all nervously. Actually, they saw Phoenix, the crack addicts at the bus stop, they saw Phoenix and his other superhero cohorts all whispering to each other, and they were, like, looking suspiciously. And what Phoenix and the other superheroes were actually whispering to each other was, I love the colour design of your gold and black mask. He said, the gold really pops. So when we turned the car, you know, he said, we'll break up some crack dealers. And I thought, well, it'll just be like when we broke up the crack addicts. But actually, it turns out, breaking up crack dealers and breaking up crack addicts, very different things.
The crack addicts are on crack. They're quite easy to take out, I'm guessing.
The crack addicts are vulnerable.
Yeah.
The crack dealers, not vulnerable. So they said, what the fuck are you doing coming here in your superhero costumes? This may be fun and games to you, but it isn't fun and games to us. If you don't get off our block, we're going to show you this. What he said, we're going to show you what the burner do. And I thought from watching The Wire that a burner was a stolen mobile phone.
Yeah.
But that didn't seem contextually. I was kind of nodding, obviously, in agreement with everything the crack dealers were saying, in the hope that if the shooting started, they'd, like, considerately shoot around me.
Yeah, because he agreed with us. Don't shoot him, he was nodding.
Yeah, exactly.
He likes...
Also, the superheroes all had, like, bulletproof vests, and I had a cardigan. Anyway, one of them said, if you... Yeah, they walked away, and then they all came back, and they had their hands down like their sweatpants, as if they had guns under there.
Yeah.
And then they came up to us, and they said, and I really thought I was going to... I thought this was it. This was worse than the Bilderberg group. And Phoenix said, do we stand or do we leave? And the other superhero said, we stand. I thought, fuck. And then they said, we ought to kill you right now, but if you're stupid enough to stand here, if we don't kill you, we're just going to have to go home. And they did. They all dispersed and went home. Phoenix won. And no. Was that an awe of being on the crack dealer's side? I don't know. I've got mixed feelings about it, frankly.
And they decided we're never going to deal crack again. We've realised how wrong it was.
Phoenix said to me, "We're just going to stand here for an hour to consolidate the block, do you want to stand with us? And I said, no, I do not. I'm very annoyed that you put me in this situation.
And when they were breaking up the crack addicts, I've just got a view, it's like in those old sitcoms where there's a drunk on a wall with a drinking some a bottle of whiskey, and then something unusual happens and he looks at the whiskey and throws it away. Is that how you dealt with the crack addicts? Going, looked at their crack pipes and look at those super... That's enough crack for me. I'm moving on from crack.
Yeah, but no, that was a long digression. But basically, yeah, the Minister at Goat's People were also trying to develop the gay bomb, which was basically a bomb that you'd drop and it would release pheromones that would turn the enemy gay. They'd be so confused that the Americans could go in and win.
I think it'd be more dangerous for the Americans to go in. Everyone's saying, oh, who are these attractive men who've just arrived with their big guns? It could work. Just making you gay doesn't mean... I mean, sort of they might all just start getting off with each other and then not be worried about... It doesn't mean you're going to have sex with each other.
Well, my guess is that it's the suddenness of the gay thoughts would make them take their mind off warfare.
Yeah. I would think that some kind of bomb had been dropped on me to make me gay. That's what I would imagine. And, I mean, you've talked so many... I'm not even going to get to any emergency questions, but it seems a shame to...
I'll take the emergency question.
Okay, I'm going to... Here's a new emergency question from last week, invented, really, by Susan Calman. If you were dying, which celebrity would you like to stroke your hair as you were dying? I went for Goldie the dog for some reason from Blue Peter. I don't know where that came from. Maybe it was the word stroke that just made me think of stroking a dog. No. Not a sick joke. It's not like Goldie from Blue Peter had a stroke. That isn't the joke. Yeah, do you know how Goldie from Blue Peter died? She had a stroke, that dog, apparently.
Yeah. No. So who's the most calming celebrity? Izzy Sooty.
Yeah. She would be good.
That's who I want to die alongside.
Okay, that's good. She is, interestingly, she has seen her own... She's been contacted by a ghost of herself. So she used to do Ouija boards, and then her from the future got in contact with her. I can't remember what she said. And she's tried to talk to the moon. Well, the moon spoke to her. I wouldn't want her around when I was dying. Fuck. She's a nut job. Good. Would you rather have a tit that dispensed talcum powder... or a finger that could travel through time? But the finger can only... You can change... You can go anywhere you want with the finger, but you can't... Only your finger can go through.
I can't see any worth for the talcum powder.
Unlimited talcum powder. Always at hand.
I don't use talcum powder.
You could give it to other people who do.
Nobody uses talcum powder.
Babies do on their bottoms. Old ladies do sometimes.
Mums.
Athletes. Mimes use it, yeah. Yeah, they do.
Yeah, the finger.
You could, if you were doing gymnastics, you could use that to put on your... Did you ever do gymnastics? Unlikely. Where would your finger go if it could travel through time? What would you do with it?
I have no idea.
No idea.
My friend...
I think you'd be ready for that.
Yeah. My friend, the podcaster, John Hodgman, has got a good... question that he asks in this situation.
All right, I'll see
which is, and there is a right and wrong answer to this. Would you rather have the power of invisibility or the power of flight?
Invisibility.
Right, well, that means that you're a fearful, crouching pervert.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Whereas, if you choose flight, you just soar.
But if I was invisible, I'd just get on planes for nothing. If your penis could travel in time, who would you have sex with in history? But only your penis can go through, so it would still be like... It'd be like having sex through a sheet or something.
Yeah.
Or a glory hole.
It is.
But it could go to anyone, and you'd have their permission as well.
Yeah. I'm thinking the silent star Clara Bow.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just because she doesn't say much.
There was a time when silent stars, you know, were sort of exotic
and
naked before they changed the rules. And they all looked so young and pretty, and now they're all dead.
So it'd be nice. Well, I feel that, you know, I feel sorry. When I even listen to, like, old radio shows and all the people are laughing, I think they're all dead.
Yeah, I think all
those people laughing, all dead.
I can't watch old films anymore. Yeah. Every time a dog walks in, I think that dog's dead. It's awful.
Yeah.
But the dogs are always dead because they only make it to, like, 15.
Yeah.
The dogs are always dead.
It's when even the people, like, one day people will be listening to this, maybe not very many people, in 50 or 60 years' time, and you'll all be laughing and they'll go, all them dead.
They're all dead.
All dead. The laughter of the dead. That's interesting, yeah, good. So, silent star. And you are a gonzo journalist. That is disgusting. You're excited now, aren't you? Does anyone ever get confused about what you're going to be doing? So, no, not, other people don't know enough about pornography to get that joke. No.
Okay.
Just me. It's the same style. It's that you are a gonzo journalist in the same way that the gonzo pornographers work. It's a POV thing. Do you know, have you heard of gonzo pornography?
No, I haven't, but you're right, it's POV.
Well, it's a POV thing, so that's why it's called gonzo, because it comes from the same thing as gonzo.
Yeah,
thing.
I get that. I mean, I did it because I just felt it was kind of ridiculous to not admit that you were in the room. It was it was crazy, you know, because, of course, you know, the first thing that happens when a journalist walks into a room is that everything changes. And if you don't admit that, then you're being dishonest. So that's why I started, you know, putting myself in stories.
And do you ever get yourself confused with Louis Farrou? Because even after I read all about you and remind... Because when I'm thinking back, I'm thinking, was that John or was that Louis who did that one?
I've noticed that.
And even now I've read everything about you, I'm still kind of going, oh, I must be careful not to say the wrong... It was good when you talked to Jimmy Savile. Well, that's...
There was a time, actually, many years ago, luckily about 15 years ago, when I was kind of, you know, feeling very competitive with Louis Theroux.
Yeah.
And I used to think that we were like sort of conjoined twins, in that for one of us to grow stronger, the other must die. and all that passed, and it passed... If I'm being completely honest, it passed when my first book was published then, because finally I had something, you know, that I could be proud of, because my documentaries, you know, were... I thought my documentaries were kind of okay, but not great. But but the books were really, really good. And so all that evaporated. And now we have dinner. I saw him I had dinner with him like 2 weeks ago. Right. And now it's all good. It's all good.
Are you trying to slyly interview each other and make yourselves admit awful things, though, while you're doing...
No, but I'll tell you what, it is weird. It is weird that when neither one of us have ever copied the other one. We've never plagiarised each other. But we have always gone down the same roads together. So when I was writing them, he was doing programmes about, you know, white supremacists and, you know, extremists and so on. And then when I did the psychopath test, he was doing programmes about... you know, over medication in America's children, and you know, the sort of tyranny of psychiatry and paedophiles being locked up for the rest of their lives and so on.
Yeah.
And now I can't really say what it is, because not because I don't mind talking about what I'm doing, but I don't know if he'd want me to talk. Once again, my next book is similar to some stuff that he's doing. So it's kind of weird that we're just on the same. I think it is. It's weird, you know, that we just are constantly going for the same things in the same order.
But you didn't go in. You haven't done any porn film. You went in a porn. That was him. Wasn't it? Or have you been in a porn film as well?
No. I'm in a porn film.
Are you?
Yes. It was something that I did for my next book, and it's not going to be in the next book, actually. I went to an S&M shoot.
That's good. That's what I'd do if I was in your position. I'm just going to be in a porn film for research. It wasn't good enough to be in the book. Nothing really happened.
I went to an S&M shoot a couple of months ago in Los Angeles. A very, very hardcore S&M.
Right.
I was trailing a dominatrix. And Everyone was so nice to me. Everyone was so nice. It was like, everyone was like rubbing my back and saying, "Are you sure you're okay?" And I was thinking, it's almost as if I'm the one whose genitals are about to be electrocuted. But it wasn't my genitals.
They were just trying to ease you into it. Fancy putting your cock in this meat grinder.
It was a late night. I said to this guy, Shyla Kobe was the producer. He had these sad eyes, looked like Deputy Dog. I really liked him. And he said, "It's all I know." He said, "I've been doing this for, you know, my whole life. It's all I know." And I said to him, "So what happened? What's going to happen?" And he said, it was a bit different because it was hardcore S&M and it had it had electrical pads and so on. And he said, "Well, but it's the same, whatever happens." He said, "They fuck, they finish, I clean up, we go home."
It's true of us all, but it's the truth of life.
It's not going to be in the book.
No. How does your wife feel? "Yeah, I was just doing the same Damascus thing and there was nothing happening." We can't really talk about it. Let's talk about Robbie Williams and UFOs. That was good. That was a few years back. But
yeah,
that was
that's in the book I've written called Lost at Sea.
Yes, yeah.
Along with Phoenix Jones, the superhero. I got a call out of the blue from Catelyn Moran.
Yeah.
Saying, "Stay by your phone, Robbie Williams is going to call you." And I thought, that's much too stressful. So I turned off my phone. I went for dinner and I came back and there was this long message from Robbie Williams saying that he was over in England shooting a video. It was the video for the one when he dressed up as Elvis and it's in Blackpool. Is it advertising?
No, these people know about the man from Del Monte, but they don't know about
Robbie Williams.
Don't know about Robbie Williams.
So he said, "Anyway, I'm in England and I want to spend a night in a haunted house and can you set one up for me?" So I called him back and I started emailing all these ladies of the manor saying, "Dear, I've read on the internet that if the portrait in your drawing room is moved, a ghost is disturbed and manifests itself. Recently, I've been contacted by the pop star Robbie Williams." 100% of the people I emailed back to say, "Yeah, our house is definitely haunted. And anytime Robbie wants to come," they're like throwing their ghosts at Robbie like they were their debutante daughters. And then Robbie decided not to do it. He said, "So I can't do it." And I thought, I'd just spend a whole fucking week on this. And I thought, no wonder Robbie Williams and ghosts get on so well. They both only manifest themselves when it suits them. But in the end, we went UFO hunting.
Oh, shit.
In Nevada. He said, "I've hired a private plane for the day." And I said, "Is this really going to happen?" He said, "It's definitely going to happen." So I flew to Los Angeles. I tell you, my favourite moment of the whole trip was he'd had his private plane, which he was feeling a bit guilty about because it was like a lot of money. And he felt bad that he spent that much money, but he wanted to make it nice. So we drove up and we got to his private plane and there was a woman standing there. And she said, "Mr. Williams, Mr. Williams' friends, welcome. This is your plane for the day. What I want to tell you," she said, "is that Snoop Dogg uses this plane a lot. What I'm saying is you can do anything." We all kind of looked at each other like, what? And Robbie's friend Brandon said, "Well, can we stand up as the plane lands?"
Very good.
Great.
Did you see any UFOs?
No, we met a couple of abductees.
Right.
I met a woman whose son was an abductee. Jason was her son. And she told Robbie Williams that he'd suffered much bullying as a result. And right. Robbie said, "Well, when did the bullying start?" And she said, "Well, it was when I brought out my book, Jason, My Indigo Child. Raising a multidimensional star child in a changing world." But Robbie was very sweet with her and very lovely and said that he felt like an abductee. when he joined Take That. That was like.
Is he a big believer in ghosts and UFOs, or is he just?
Yeah. No, I think he wanted to. I said in my card psychological theory, which is that. You know, what does a young kid want? He wants to be like the most famous pop star in the world. He wants to play stadiums. And so everything that every kid wants happened to Robbie Williams, and he found it wanting. And so he wanted something else. He wanted something outside of himself. And what's better than that? It's space aliens. And he needed, I think he very desperately needed a break. In fact, I made this documentary about it, called Robbie Williams and John Ronson Journey to the Other Side. And a couple of people actually accused me of not exploiting him, because he was completely in on it, but, you know, but basically documenting this very vulnerable time for Robbie Williams. And I always saw it as the opposite. I always saw, actually, him doing this journey as that he was really fucked from touring and playing these stadiums all the time, and he was totally fucked up. And actually doing this UFO adventure was like his way of getting better.
Right.
Yeah, I saw it as him not, you know, being exploited for being vulnerable, but actually the healing process.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting, because I suppose you could level that at quite a lot of that. Your interviewees are vulnerable people, and you're...
Except I never am. I never, ever am. I mean, it would be... Because the implication of that is that I somehow consider myself, like, better than them. I never consider myself better than the people I'm interviewing. I think we are all... Like what I was saying about me and Louis from years back, you know, I was so fucked up about that, and it's so stupid, you know? But in my bubble, it meant everything. I'm very aware that we're all fucked up. We're all, you know, we've all got our irrationalities that matter hugely to us and look ridiculous on the outside. Yeah. And so I do not in any way feel superior to anybody I ever write about. For me, it's like a kind of shared embracing of people's absurdities and flaws, and not a kind of hierarchical. What I hate more than anything is hierarchical journalism and hierarchical Twitter and, you know, hierarchical... legal system. You know, I hate, you know, and so I very strongly feel that what I'm doing is trying to kind of dismantle hierarchies by kind of giving dignity to the sort of people that other people would attack.
Sure. And I think that's true, because you are, there's a sort of low status to you, in that I think you are quite neurotic, and you are, I mean, that whole thing, you've been chased by the Bilderberg Group Benjamin, you come in this, you're the last person you would expect to get yourself in that situation. I mean, maybe I'm the last person, because I'd be too scared to do it, to do all the things that you do. But it is, I suppose that's why it works.
Yeah, I think so. And also the fact that I'm not, I mean, I'm like the opposite of Donal McIntyre, you know, who would like, I remember one time he was doing something on the fashion industry, and somebody gave him some cocaine, and he had all these hidden cameras, and the first thing he did was went into the toilet and, like, got the cocaine and just sort of, you know, put it into the toilet with this kind of disgusted look on his face, like he'd never seen cocaine before. Like, I worked for the fucking BBC. And for me, that sort of performance, that kind of hierarchical performance journalism is basically what I consciously feel, but I used to unconsciously feel, is what I'm trying to kind of, in my own little way, to sort of dismantle.
Sure. Yeah. And if anyone is going to be getting an answer to this question, I guess it'll be you. Have you ever seen a Bigfoot?
No. Actually, I did some stuff.
You wore the T-shirt and everything.
Yeah, sorry. No. Never seen any mythical beasts.
It wouldn't be mythical if you'd seen it, so... Maybe you've seen it and it's no longer mythical. Do you think the world might be run by Bigfoots? It's a secret cabal of Bigfoots.
I don't believe so. Okay. I think nobody controls anything.
Have you come on this show to kind of psychoanalyze me, because I'm a weirdo, is my other weird, because you asked to come on this.
Yeah.
What and is... I kind of thought, is this another, there's a bloke in London who asks people if they've ever tried to suck their own cock, let's go and see, write a book about him.
Well, the reason I asked to come on it was because both you, there's like, on Twitter, like two things kept coming up time and time again, which was people saying, when are you going to be on Mark Maron?
Right.
And people saying, when are you going to be on Richard Herring? So I just thought I might as well tell you that I was going to be in London, because I'm living in New York at the moment. Living in New York.
London is not good enough for you, isn't it?
Basically, it's just like living in London, except I have far fewer friends. And that's why I said to you, I'm coming, you know, people have said. I mean, did you notice on Twitter people saying, when are you going to have John Ransom on?
Yeah. But I get people asking all the time for the one. You know, I only have people on that I like. Mm-hmm. It's nice if they ask as well. Yeah. That was good. It was very. We were actually standing at that bar going, who are we going to have on in the last show? And then I got your direct message saying, can I come on? Yeah. So it was like some kind of conspiracy and some kind of tense. Someone was listening in.
But you could have said no if you didn't want.
I know. I would have said no if I didn't want you on.
Yeah.
I was very, very excited. I thought more people would come. But
I have no idea how many people are here.
There seems to be an almost full room. Almost. Look at those eight seats there. The irony is someone's paid for those seats, right?
Also, I don't know why people don't choose the front row. You get the extra leg room. It's like when I'm on a plane, right? I'm on a plane and I can see that the exit seats are, like, free. And I'm thinking, fuck, as soon as, like, they say that everybody's on board, I'm going to, like, get out of my crappy seat and move into the exit seat. But everyone must be thinking the same thing. And I'm thinking, fuck, everyone must be thinking the same thing. And I think, and then they say it, and then I kind of jump up my seat and run towards the exit seat, and I'm always the only one to do it. And the reason why is because the other people on the plane are more well-balanced than I am. But there's much more legroom in the front row.
So you have to sit next to these guys, and they are properly weird. You could definitely there's definitely something in this. If you follow these two around, you're going to find all kinds of stuff going on with them. Yeah. We've nearly got to finish, but I'll try and think. We'll see what else we can slip in. Well, I don't know if there's anything, but you were granted access to the Stanley Kubrick archive exclusively. How did that happen? How do you get all these things happen to you? Robbie Williams rings you up and the men who stare at goats ring you up. So why were you chosen to look at his archive and what was in there?
Well, basically, I made a documentary years ago, a radio documentary called Hotel Auschwitz, about the marketing of Auschwitz. And I got this call from this posh voice after the documentary went out saying, my employer would very much like a copy of your documentary. And I said, who's your employer? And he said, I'm afraid I can't tell you. And I said, oh, go on. Anyway, Stanley Kubrick. And
that's why you're a brilliant journalist.
he was an easy wall to break down, I've got to say.
I'll remember that. I'll go on.
Yeah. So
I'm going to use that in the next one. Next one.
I later discovered why. It's because he was planning a documentary about the Holocaust called Aryan Papers. Either called Aryan Papers or Wartime Lies, but he spent so long planning it that Spielberg made Schindler's List, and then so he dumped it. But anyway, I never heard anything again once I sent the tape in, and then he died. And then about a year after he died, I got an invitation. The posh voice phoned again, the posh man, and he said, do you want to come up for lunch to the house? And it was Stanley Kubrick's house, this kind of giant house between St. Albans and Harpenden. And it was just filled with boxes. It looked like the Inland Revenue had taken it over. And I said, what's in the boxes? And he said, everything. We never threw anything away. And I got home and said to my wife, you know, God, Stanley Kubrick's house is just full of boxes. And she said, you should ask them if you can look through them. So I did. And I spent years on and off going back and forward to Kubrick's house.
So you went, you had the journalist integrity to go, I'll go on, but when you were in the house, you know, can I look in those boxes? Yeah. That was your wife had to say. Yeah. Why didn't you ask to look in the boxes? Oh, yeah. I didn't think of that when I was there.
I tell you my favourite one. My very, very favourite one was there was a porter cabin that was filled with photographs of London, like millions of doorways and mortuaries and costume shops and like everything you can think of, like basically all of London was in this porter cabin practically, and all the photographs were taken by Manuel Harlan, who was Kubrick's nephew, and it was all location shots for Eyes Wide Shut. Right. And so I interviewed Manuel after I looked at these photographs, and he said at one point Kubrick wanted him to photograph the whole of Commercial Road in East London, right? But he didn't want the buildings going back and forward, so he had to take a ladder, and he had to climb a ladder, take a photograph, come down, move the ladder like 6 inches, climb up again, take another photograph until he got a panorama of that. It was like Google Street View before it was invented, of the whole of Commercial Road, and it took him like months, and Kubrick was like phoning up all the time, going, hey, are you done? Come back, what are you going to do? And so he kind of like did it, like got to the whole of Commercial Road, both sides, long road, finishes, goes to Snappy Snaps, gets them developed, and then assiduously, like, sellotapes them together. So you've got, like, a perfect panorama of the whole of Commercial Road. And then he got back to the Kubrick house and, like, laid them down this really long corridor. And then Kubrick comes out of his quarters and, like, looks at them and goes, well, it sure beats going there.
Brilliant. It's been fantastic talking to you. It's now 11:11. No, it's not. Yeah. Whenever he looks at his watch, it's 11:11.
It's always 11:11, and it will happen to you all now.
Your now watch on. Is broken.
Every time you look at your watch, it'll say 11:11.
Your watch is broken. It's not. It's quarter to nine. We didn't talk about Jonathan King. Maybe another time. Ladies and gentlemen, give a big round of applause to my guest, John Ronson. Fantastic. Thank you
very much.
How'd you like them sky potatoes?
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And go fasterstripe.com. You can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. I do come and say hello after the show if you enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.